that is our introduction for today's program. With a cordial welcome to all who are listening, and a particularly cordial welcome to a great radio veteran and a great expert on the history of American radio. Chuck Shaden, that's a name known undoubtedly to many of our listeners. Indeed, you know, Chuck, I was thinking about this, just looking at your vita and remembering my own. You and I are two of the people who've been on Chicago radio just about as long as anybody, still extant.
I think so, yes, could be.
Started at the WGN in 1974 and ran that until the end of 2012. That was 38 mm-hmm. years. Mm-hmm. Your program, Those Were the Days, which was a program focused on the history of American radio, with wonderful excerpts from all sorts of programming, started in 1970, and you finally, in essence, retired from it in 2009. So that's 39 years.
39 years, in honor of my great and good fan and friend, Jack Benny, of course.
Right.
In his honor, right.
He was a perpetual 39-year-old. And we are going to be doing a version of Those Were the Days again today.
Well, that's nice and appropriate, too.
Well, it's always appropriate. Radio is a great medium, and it has changed a lot, of course.
Certainly.
And the kind of radio that you celebrated isn't there much anymore, except in programs which revive it.
That's right. Well, our Those Were the Days program, from which I retired in 2009, is still continuing. It's still on the air. Another gentleman is hosting and producing, Steve Darnall, and it's in the same time slot on Saturday afternoons on the College of DuPage Radio. And this program, Those Were the Days, started in this very studio.
Exactly.
Almost exactly where I'm sitting.
That's what I discovered only a few weeks ago when the AFTRA-SAG players were here, and they've been with me a few times, and one of them said that you had started your broadcast from this very studio. And I said, no, that's not possible. And he said, yes, it is, and ask Chuck. And you confirmed it for me today, but I had already managed to confirm it otherwise. I want to talk more about that and the beginnings of your career. But first, we're going to go directly to some favorites from old-time radio. And my first is Vic and Sade. But before we play a single excerpt, and we'll be doing loads of those today, how does one define old-time radio? When does old-time begin? When does it end?
Well, old-time radio is a generic term that we apply basically to the what was considered the golden age of radio.
Yeah.
And it was one of the shortest golden ages of any golden age ever. Basically, the golden age of radio was from about 1935 to 1955, maybe 20 years. Now, expand that by maybe 10 years in the beginning and another 5 or 6 years in the ending, and that is pretty much the age of radio. But the golden age, where there were really programs that dominated family life, started about 1930-35 and took listeners through the Depression, World War II, the post-war economy, and
a lot of them came from the city of Chicago.
Chicago was really one of the hubs for radio during its heyday.
And one great American program that was originated in Chicago and had its full run from studios, I think maybe at WMAQ, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, WMAQ.
Was Vic and Sade.
But written by Paul Reimer.
Paul Reimer. Mm-hmm. I think it's American comedy, gentle, but wonderfully thoughtful and charming and eccentric, more so than just about anything. And I was a great fan of it. You knew Fred McDonald, of course.
Yes, of course.
And Fred and was also a great Vic and Sade fan. One night, we did a whole Vic and Sade program, and we got on the phone from Chicago, Billy Idelson, who played Rush in the original group. Let's hear Vic and Sade, but say a word about what they were first.
Well, it was basically a three- or four-character story that ran for a quarter hour every weekday. And the story itself was uninterrupted by any of the commercials. But it was, so the story itself was maybe 10 or 12 minutes. And you had Victor Gook and his wife Sade. And you had their adopted son Rush and
Uncle Fletcher.
Uncle Fletcher.
Yes, who was a touch on the senescent side.
He was.
In rather a charming way.
And he was a really good character. And sometimes we'd have a whole show, a quarter-hour show, that was written without Vic and without Uncle Fletcher, but maybe with Sade and Rush. Or you might have Uncle Fletcher and Rush, or just two, because today, somebody be on vacation.
And today we have Rush and his mother, Sage.
That's right.
And we'll hear all about it right now.
Certainly a swell day, ain't it, boy?
Yeah. By tonight, there might be a thunderstorm come up.
I doubt it.
You can't ever tell about August weather that way. Why, one time there in Dixon, it come up a hailstorm so big that the whole town was covered with hail a foot deep. I remember.
Oh, I never told you.
Huh?
I still haven't told you about Rooster Davis and the bacon sandwiches.
Well, tell it.
Go ahead with what you were telling.
Well, that's all there was to it. One time in Dixon, during what looked like a calm summer day, it come up a hailstorm to where the ground was covered a foot deep.
Very remarkable.
What about Rooster and the sandwiches?
He's going to start a restaurant.
Uh-huh.
In this restaurant, he's going to sell nothing but bacon sandwiches.
Hmm.
Going to deal in bacon sandwiches exclusively.
Hmm.
Restaurant's going to be right downtown.
Yeah.
Corner of Main and Jefferson Streets.
Oh, there you go again.
How do you mean?
Well, instead of telling a thing and finishing it, you just say one sentence at a time and make a person answer.
Oh.
What about Rooster and his bacon sandwiches?
Well, he's going to have a live pig out in back of the restaurant, see?
Uh-huh.
And whenever a customer comes in and orders a bacon sandwich, Rooster steps outdoors with a knife and cuts off a piece of bacon.
Cuts it off the pig?
Sure. All bacon comes from pigs.
Well, I know that, foolish. What's the point?
The point is that the pig's alive.
Well?
The pig is given ether and chloroform so it won't hurt. A chunk of bacon is removed. A trained nurse steps forward and nurses the pig back to health and strength. He eats his dinner and gets fat, making more bacon. Another customer wants a sandwich, so Rooster again puts his pig to sleep with ether and chloroform and again cuts off a chunk. Sure. See, all you need is one pig. He don't lead a very gay life of it, what with being stabbed every little...
Ish.
Huh?
Ish.
Okay.
Here comes Mr. Foster on his bicycle.
Uh-huh.
He's got his dinner bucket tied to his handlebars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going in the house.
Oh, why, ma'am?
Well, I got things to do.
Well, it's been a pleasant chat.
Yeah.
That's such a wonderfully gentle and always whimsical and slightly eccentric turn to it.
You know, many of the shows were written while they were on the air. Paul Reimer had an idea for the start of the show, and as it began, he'd be down the hall at a typewriter, batting out the end of the story. And
I've
he'd
never
bring
heard
the
that.
Pages in to some of these actors who were doing it. But they all worked so well together. Now, the actress who played Sade was Bernadine Flynn, a Chicago actress who had done many, many things. And, of course, that was Bill Idelson, who was Rush. And Vic was played by Art Van Harvey. And later, when Clarence Hartzell came in on the scene, when Harvey was sick for a while and unable to appear, and they needed another voice, so that's when Reimer wrote in the character of Uncle Fletcher, and he was played by Clarence Hartzell.
Uh-huh.
So they all worked very well together.
They did. How long did it run, from when to when?
Well, it was mostly through the early 1940s.
Yeah.
Very late 30s.
And it was
early
national.
1940s. It was national out of Chicago.
Yeah.
And they're both out of print now, but there were two books written featuring complete Vic and Sade scripts in them that Mr. Reimer's widow put out a few years back.
Going on, because we got so much on this wonderful playlist, Jack Benny is a major presence in American radio, of course. And one of his foils was his singer, Dennis Day.
Mm-hmm.
And here we've got a scene involving both of them, and I guess Dennis does some singing as well. And I know that you... On your program, you did interviews with a number of important performers in American radio. And right after this, I think we'll listen to you talking to Jack Benny.
Fine.
But here first is Jack Benny talking to Dennis Day.
Oh, hello, Dennis. Hey, Dennis, you're just in time for your song.
Okay, Mr. Benny, I'm glad I got here in time. On the way down, I had to stop off at our family doctor's office and punch him in the nose.
You punched your doctor in the nose?
He had it coming. My mother told me what he did.
What?
When I was born, for no reason at all, he slapped me.
Dennis.
And my back was turned, too.
Dennis. Never mind that. Let's have your song.
Okay, but first, congratulations on your birthday.
Oh, well, it's awfully sweet of you to remember it, kid.
I never would have thought of it if you hadn't given me that ticket to the burlesque show last night.
Never mind, Dennis.
What did the burlesque show have to do with it?
Well, a girl came out to do a dance, her bubble broke, and a sign fell out saying Monday is Jack Benny's birthday.
Dennis.
You must be popular. Boy, what applause you got.
All right.
They whistled and everything.
Dennis.
What a fuss over a man's birthday.
Dennis, you found out it was my birthday. That's all that matters. Now, come on, let's have your song.
Okay. Gee, when I'm 40, I hope I don't look like him.
What did you say?
Sing, Dennis.
That's better. Go ahead.
Let the raindrops fall, la 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 la. I don't mind at all, la 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 la. When I get your call, la 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 la.
A necessary fade. We've got so much that we want to play. But it's interesting. Dennis is in a role that lots of others played with lots of other comedians. That is, the singer who very often was a foil as part of the comic routine.
Yeah, that's true, but not all of them were Dennis Day, because
he was
had
the best.
So much.
He was the best.
He came on as a very nervous, scared young singer.
Right.
And that's all he was going to do, but Jack and Mary and the others on the show saw some potential in Dennis, and they started giving him additional lines, and pretty soon he was a very important part of the program. Now, in some shows he played a more prominent role than in others, but very often, Dennis had a page or a page and a half of dialogue with Jack or some of the other characters on the show, and that was it. But boy, those lines were so perfectly crafted and so well written, and just like Phil Harris and Mary Livingston and all the others, they really made this a terrific radio program.
They did,
Jack
indeed.
Was the number one show on radio for many, many, many years, and is generally accepted to be the greatest comedian ever heard on radio, and he rarely told a joke. He was always the butt of a joke. The jokes were around him and about him, but he never really came right out and told a joke.
That's true. I hadn't really realized that, but as you say, it's obviously the case.
Mm-hmm.
But the joke was in his character.
Oh, yes, of course. And the audience knew his character so well that so many times a scene was set up in such a way that the audience would start laughing before Jack even got to say the line.
He was. What are the proper adjectives? He was vain. He was miserly. What else defines the many characters?
He was a skinflint.
Yeah.
You're right. Vain and miserly. And he had a toupee.
And he lied about his age.
Always lying about his age. You know? And he skinflint is really a good one because he had the Maxwell automobile that really was an old wreck, and he wouldn't spend any money.
Well, he also had the vault down in the basement.
He kept his money in the vault, and the listeners took him all the way down the stairs to a vault.
Now, you did a series of interviews with some of the great figures in American radio, and you did one with Jack Benny.
I did.
We're going to hear some of it right now. What should we listen for?
Well, listen, this is this was one of the earliest interviews that I did. I started on radio right here in this station.
That's what I've learned.
On May the 2nd.
In this studio.
Of 1970.
Yeah.
And on September the 3rd of 1970, I was at the now-defunct Mill Run Theater in Niles, Illinois, interviewing Jack Benny. And there, I couldn't believe it. I had, who had grown up listening to Jack, listening on the floor of our living room in front of that Zenith console radio with the flickering green eye, listening to Jack. And here I am sitting across from him in the theater talking about his career. And he told me this.
What happened was, the last year that I was with General Foods, so I had a few shows that weren't as hot. But I still had a lot of great shows.
So this was in the middle 40s?
It was, something.
The so-called famous Jack Benny slump, that you moved from number one to number seven.
Or something like that,
right?
Or they thought, so they practically said to me, watch it a little bit, because some of the shows, as though every show had to be perfect, you know. See, I spoiled them. So the minute they said that, I went to my... And then they went back to New York. Now, they didn't have an option. The thing was over. But they did want to give me a new contract. But the way they said to me, just watch a little bit, I got mad. So I said to my manager, I said, let's get another sponsor. I don't want to be with them. And we wired them on the train as they were going back that we will not be with them anymore. Because right away I had like four or five big offers from Lucky Strike, from everybody. Mm-hmm. And we grabbed Lucky Strike immediately. Then, of course, Yellow came back and said, we didn't mean to hurt your feet, all this and that, but it was too late. So then I stayed with Lucky Strikes for years.
Yeah. Is it true, Mr. Benny, that NBC once gave you an option on the 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock time slot on Sunday nights?
Yeah, they told me as long as I would stay with them, I could have that time. Now, this was not in writing, but it was a definite agreement that I could have that time as long as I wanted to stay with them. But when I moved to CBS, CBS gave me exactly that same time. So I moved, and I didn't want to leave NBC. I loved NBC. But I had to make some kind of a deal where I could make some money, because here I was getting a terrific salary and was all salary. And I couldn't make a deal for a company. Well, I wouldn't care if I got $1 million a week. That wouldn't do me any good. What good would that be?
But the income tax, right.
Sure.
Right.
So the ones that made me the deal and came right through with it quick was CBS. Then, of course, when NBC realized I was going to go, then they were willing to make the deal. But I didn't want to play one against the other, so I merely took CBS.
Well, there he is in his own real nature, still focused on money.
That's right. And he was talking how he moved from NBC to CBS. And
I do remember that his opening when Jell-O was sponsoring him would often be Jell-O again.
That's what he said.
Rather than hello again.
Right. Yeah. Six delicious flavors.
We're about to pause. You know what happens in radio? You stop every so often.
Absolutely.
For what do you think they're called?
A commercial message.
Commercials, right. There you are.
This is Milt Rosenberg on Chicago's Smart Talk, WCGO.
And our very special guest today is none other than Chuck Shaden, who is the town's leading expert, I would say in all probability the country's leading expert, on old-time radio. And indeed, Fred McDonald, whom I mentioned earlier, was the other one that I would rank with you. Fred was an historian of American entertainment media.
Fred was a little more scholarly than I am.
Well, the two of you covered the same territory, at least. Well, he went on to television and movies and so on. Mm-hmm. But his first book was titled Don't Touch That Dial.
Right. A very good title.
And that's a phrase from one of the famous radio programs.
Oh, it came from Blondie.
From Blondie.
There was a series called Blondie, and it was Bill Goodwin, who right at the very top of the show would say, don't touch that dial.
There we are.
Stay tuned for, and then Arthur Lake, who played Dagwood, would say, Blondie! The audience would scream, and the music would roll, and we were in for a visit with the Bumsteads of Shady Lane Avenue.
This is the list for today has been put together by a number of people. Some advice from me, or some requests from me. A lot of work from our producer, Mr. French, and from our engineer, Mr. Mikulski, and one that they turned up that I didn't even know about is Ernie Kovacs. I remember Ernie Kovacs on television.
Oh, sure.
But it turns out he did a radio monologue kind of program on NBC's Monitor. What was Monitor?
Monitor was NBC's answer to the golden age of radio. After the golden age really was gone, the gold now tarnished. NBC came up with what they called a weekend radio service called Monitor, going places and doing things, they said. And it was news, it was sports, it was features, it was dramatic things, it was comedians, all the big comedians from radio, Bob Hope, Red Skelton, Fibber McGee and Molly, others like that. They had little 3 or 4 minute vignettes that played throughout the weekend. usually started, it started earlier on Saturdays and all day Saturday and Sunday. Then they fudged a little and added Friday nights to it. But we had, it was NBC's weekend service. Boop, 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 monitor, going places and doing things, they'd say.
I really don't remember.
And they drew from television comedians as well, and that's when they enlisted Ernie Kovacs.
So he was already on television.
He was already on television. It was very highly visible programming, which he could never have done on radio.
I remember his wonderful Nairobi trio.
That's right. That's right.
Three chimpanzees. But here he is... from NBC's monitor, and he's dealing with various genre in radio itself. Let's listen.
Ernie Kovacs, brought to you by L&M Cigarettes.
Here he is, Ernie Kovacs, the writer. I have another postcard from our old screenwriter friend, Tuborg Bessemer, who writes, "Dear Ernie, as you know from my last postcard, I am now writing mystery pictures. I used the lines of dialogue you gave me, and now I have to write two more pictures. Can you give me some fresh lines, as I don't want Migraine Studios to say I'm getting stale?" "Well, certainly, Tuborg. However, there are no fresh lines of dialogue for mystery pictures. They're the same old lines used over and over. But at any rate, here are some others that you'll find handy. Just wrap a flimsy pot around them, and you'll have two more feature films. Now, start with this one. I want everybody that was in this room at the time of the murder to take his place exactly where he was when Mendel Cartwright was killed. Carruthers, you was in that chair by the fireplace. Oh, so was you, Miss Gelman. And I think you were too, Miss Melrose. And Miss Catcalf. I believe you were in that chair too, that same one, Miss Lillemeyer. And Miss Melmer. Don't argue with me, Carruthers. I got a photographic memory. You too, Miss Peters, in the same chair. Let's see, Miss Lucas, Miss Preben, Miss Bram, Miss Singleton. Carruthers, stick your head up high. I can't see you so good. Miss Fulton, you was in that chair. Miss Gingo, Miss Hartman, and the rest of you who was standing around that piano. Everybody in the chair. Look here, Inspector. The bullet entered here, just below the ankle. Another went through his arm, another through his shoulder, two in the back. The knife wounds seem to be located in the chest and right calf. This 8-foot long busy spear caught him in the back of the neck, 7 arrows in the backs of his legs. Inspector, I am beginning to believe it wasn't suicide after all. I have made a deep study of these things. The vampires come after the sun goes down. We must put some wolfbane on the door and tie the frog's legs in the little bag around her neck. Or is it that we put the wolfbane on the neck and the dried frog's legs on the door? Or was it dried frog's legs? Or was it creamed mushrooms? Let me think. Watson, the man who did this, was 6 feet tall, walked with a limp in his right foot, wore saddle shoes with brown laces, ate pastrami sandwiches with English mustard, spoke Swahili, and wore suspenders inscribed to Albert with love, Daphne. How do I know all this? Elementary. Daphne told me, Watson.
Ernie Kovacs is also brought to you by RCA, the Radio Corporation of America, and RCA Victor, First in Home Entertainment.
I've never heard that before.
You know,
I found it quite charming. It's really a takeoff on many different modes of mystery drama.
Right. You know what was missing on that?
What?
Audience.
Yeah.
The live studio audience. We heard it with Jack Benny and Dennis Day, spontaneity from the audience. We didn't hear a studio audience from Vic and Sade earlier today because
they didn't have a
studio audience.
Yeah.
In fact, they didn't get many loud guffaws, but they got that wonderful warm chuckle that comes from the heart of the individual listener.
Absolutely.
But many of the comedians that we listened to during the Golden Age, as I said before, Fibber and Molly and Jack Benny, and not Jack Benny, but Fibber and Molly and... Burns and Allen and others did these little vignettes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, something like that, and they would go into one of the NBC studios someplace, West Coast or East Coast, and record a half a dozen or more of these little clips in a single session, and then NBC would cut them up and drop them in their schedule on the monitor weekend from time to time, and then maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks later they go into the studio again and do some other things, but not any studio audience while they would do this. And those of us who grew up listening to these radio shows with the studio audience leading the laughter missed it.
Mm-hmm.
We missed having that spontaneity of laughter that came from the studios.
Monitor was, in a way, a reflection on the history of radio, of old-time radio towards the end of the old-time radio period.
Well, it didn't do anything about the history of radio, but it did preserve some of the personalities of radio for a little longer. But it was disappointing to us who were looking for a half-an-hour Fred Allen show, for example.
That was dated 1959,
yeah.
The Ernie Kovacs
yeah.
thing we just heard.
Right.
We're about to pause for a quick round of commercials. And then coming up, the other great radio comic of that time, which has to be, of course,
Fred Allen.
Mm-hmm.
This is Milt Rosenberg on Chicago's Smart Talk, 1590 WCGO.
And back to Chuck Shaden, with whom we are, in a way, reviving his old program, Those Were the Days, which ran with Chuck doing it. Somebody else is still doing a version of it even now. But Chuck did it from 1970 through 2009. That was a long run.
It was, and it seemed like just yesterday.
And, of course, you also were in the nostalgia objects business. I remember, I was never at the store, but I remember you had a store where people went to buy all sorts of items that were generally in the category of nostalgia.
We had a store called Metro Golden Memories.
Memories, yes.
Yes, it was first on West Irving Park Road, then on West Addison Street.
Uh-huh.
And we had 25 or 28 years, something like that. And I kind of retired from that. And that's around the same time that the internet stuff was piling up a lot of things like that.
So now we come to Fred Allen. You agree that he's the other great radio comic of that period.
Yeah. Fred Allen was really, he was considered to be the comic's comic. He was the comedian's comedian. He was
in what way?
An intellectual. He was a man who he wrote almost all of the material himself, and he was a tireless worker. In fact, he was so tireless writing his 30-minute, first it was a 60-minute program, later mm-hmm. became a 30-minute show, that he had almost no time for anything else. But he worked very hard. He was a great ad-libber. He hardly ever got his show off on time because with a 30-minute show, he had a few ad-libs and such great audience reaction and response that with laughter and applause, they would run late.
And he knew how to kid himself or even how to kid the medium. Here is a clip with Harry Von Zell, who mm-hmm. was his announcer, and they're having fun at the cost of their sponsor. Let's listen to it.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. Someone once said that the world stands aside to make way for the man who knows where he's going. And so tonight it gives me great pleasure to make way for a man who knows what he's talking about. Harry Von Zell.
Don't ever neglect the cold. At the very first sign of a cold, get after it immediately with the faster help of what's the name?
Fred Allen, remember?
No. The name of the... I'm awfully sorry, that eagle has upset me. I can't remember the name of what it is that helps fight colds faster. It slips my mind.
Well, it'll come to you. Go ahead, Harry.
Well, yes, of course. Ladies and gentlemen, this famous product acts very quickly, yet it's exceptionally gentle. And since the progress of a cold is very fast, the greater speed of what it is I'm talking about is especially important in fighting your cold. And that's not all. This, the name will come to me in a minute. It also helps nature counteract the acidity that so often accompanies a cold. And ladies and gentlemen, you can check these facts with your own doctor.
You'd better check the name, too, ladies and gentlemen.
Fred, you know what I'm talking about.
Why,
don't
certainly,
you?
Harry. You're talking about America's outstanding saline laxative.
That's it, Fred. And the name is...
The name is, so many physicians recommend
it. Yes. And it helps fight colds faster. But what is the name?
Well, here's a pretty to-do. Wait, Harry. There must be somebody around here who knows. If there is, would you please tell us confidentially? That's it. Sal Hepatica. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Fred Allen. He was on the air for Sal Hepatica and Ipana toothpaste. And they used to say Ipana for the smile of health yeah. and sell Hepatica for the smile of beauty, or the other way around.
You know the great story about the great radio blooper by Harry Von Zell?
Yes, he told it to me. In one of our conversations, he told us about, well, he said he was making a statement about the President of the United States, Herbert Hoover.
I believe he was introducing him.
No, he was talking about
just
him.
Just talking
He'd
about
done
him.
A big buildup about him before the introduction was going to come. And he's told his whole story, and he says, Hebert Hoover, or Hoover Haver, Hoover, anyway,
Hubert Hoover.
Hubert Hoover, yeah. It was amazing. And then he kept that with him for the rest of his life, and was very good-natured about it.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the great announcer presences.
Oh, yeah, he was.
In radio.
He was with Fred Allen. He was with Eddie Cantor. He was with Burns and Allen for a long time.
There were one
he became more than a straight, legitimate
there
announcer.
There were one or two other very famous announcers who were all over the place.
Well, Don Wilson. And
Wilson was with Jack Benny.
With Jack Benny and with a number of many others.
Various others.
And Harlow Wilcox, who announced...
With Fibber McGee and Molly.
Fibber and Molly, yeah. I just mentioned the name and you remember...
Yes, well, I love the Fibber McGee program. We're going to hear some of it. And you have an interview with Jim Jordan,
who
played Fibber.
Yes, right.
We are just about due for a quick round of commercials and then...
Already?
Well, I'm working it in early so we can get to... I'll tell you what, let's not.
No, go ahead.
No, because I see it looking at the clock. I could go either way. And the next one is actually Fred Allen's show, and it's fairly short, and it's one of his great scenes, one of his great characters. He had Allen's Alley.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly, make clear what Allen's Alley was.
Well, it was a vignette on every one of the Fred Allen shows for a long time, especially when he was on the 30-minute time slot. And he would walk down Allen's Alley, which was like Schubert Alley, or it wasn't really an alley. It was a street, but it was called Allen's Alley.
With four or five residents that he would stop with.
Senator Claghorn, he said Mrs. Nussbaum, and he had all kinds of different people.
He had the New England guy played by...
Parker Fennelly.
Parker Fennelly. Mr. Something or Other.
Yeah, but they... And he had... You know, see, you retire and you forget some of them.
Well, anyway, Claghorn was one of my favorites. He was a bombastic Southern senator.
Well, he was played by one of the big radio announcers of all time.
Kenny Delmar,
right. Yeah.
Who also was a significant occasional actor in film. Mm-hmm. Do you know this? Do you remember the great film with Marlon Brando as Zapata?
I know the film. I don't remember Delmar being...
Kenny Delmar is in that film, Pancho Villa.
Really?
Check it out.
Wow. We'll
I'm
have
quite
to do
sure.
That,
I'm quite sure. Anyway, here we are with a visit with Senator Claghorn.
The senator's home. I'll knock and see what happens.
Somebody, I say, somebody knock.
Yes, I know.
Claghorn's the name. Senator Claghorn, that is.
I know you're from the South.
When I'm in New York, I'll never go to the Yankee Stadium.
Now, wait.
I won't even go to see the Giants unless the South Pole pitches.
Well, look.
To watch the Dodgers unless Dixie Walker's playing.
Now, wait a minute.
Stop interrupting. Where's your manners?
Manners? I have manners.
Try listening. You might learn something.
Listen, all I'll ever learn.
Your tongue's wagging like a blind dog's tail in a meat market.
You're winded, hey?
You're sucking in some air, son.
Tell me, Senator, what is Washington doing about coal prevention?
The Senate reconvened just in time.
Yeah?
I was glad to see Senator Aiken back. Aiken back, that's a joke.
I know it's a joke.
That was a funny fact, Flint.
Listen, you don't know what it is.
I keep crossing them and you just sidestep them.
Well, look at this. Now, wait.
Say, you're a regular sad sack. Sack, that is.
Now, you wait. Now, just a second. Do you have a favorite cure for a cold?
I caught a cold last week.
Yeah.
I'd like to ruin my filibuster.
Ruin the filibuster? What did you do?
I took an old Southern remedy, son. I drank down 2 buckets of hot mint julep.
You drank 2 buckets of hot mint juleps and you still held the floor?
Held the floor? Son, I couldn't get up off it.
Now, would you guess that all of that was written by Allen?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Word for word.
Word for word.
Yeah.
Even the retorts and everything else.
Uh-huh.
Kenny Delmar, the announcer on this show. Now I remember. Titus Moody and Ajax Cassidy.
Right.
Were the other two members of the
Ajax Cassidy is an Irishman.
Right.
And Titus Moody is the New Englander.
New Englander, yeah. Right. Howdy, bub.
Exactly.
You see? Right.
Played by Parker Fennelly.
Right.
Who also did the same routine in certain movies.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
And he was the same guy who years later on television was the truck driver for a Mrs. Oh, gee. Now, here I go again. It was a New England type product that he was selling.
Could it have been Pepperidge Farm?
Pepperidge Farm, that's right.
Yeah.
It's Pepperidge Farm, you're right. Yeah.
Well, I never would have thought of it spontaneously, but when you.
But he used the same voice.
Yeah. Yeah. The Yankee voice, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We pause. Now we do pause for a quick round of commercials, and then right back.
This is Milt Rosenberg on Chicago's Smart Talk, 1590 WCGO.
Chuck, I'm breaking the order on the playlist to go to something that's just about the earliest broadcast we have represented here.
Mm-hmm.
It's from 1939, it's Elmer Davis. Do you know that name?
Newscaster.
It's a news
very important during World War II broadcast.
Exactly, and that's what this is all about. Mm-hmm. This is a broadcast from September 15th, 1939, and the title of the program is, at least as I have it here, Today the War is 2 weeks old.
No, that's the subject matter. That's probably his opening line.
Yeah.
Because it was Elmer Davis and the news.
Quite so. That's the subject matter for this particular broadcast. It was a nightly broadcast, as I remember.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is from the very beginning of the period that we've been talking about, the 1940s and 50s. Here we are going into war.
Today the war is 2 weeks old. 2 weeks that have been a surprise to everybody except the German general staff and possibly even to them. That the Germans, unless much of their forces had to be diverted to meet British and French attacks, could beat the Poles was generally admitted. But nobody expected the Germans to get so far so soon. Things look a little better for the Poles this evening. The German attacks on Brest-Litovsk have so far failed to capture the city. And the Warsaw radio reports that part of the Polish army that was trapped in the western provinces has broken through the German ring and joined the defenders of the capital. But there's another and wider German ring far to the east of Warsaw, a ring that will apparently be closed if Brest-Litovsk is taken. And it remains to be seen whether the great concentration of Polish troops in the capital will ever get out. In any case, some of the nations that have been watching from the sidelines seem to think that the Polish war is about over and are taking precautions so that, as the Moscow newspaper Pravda puts it, events shall not take them unawares. For 2 days now, we've been hearing talk from Moscow of the creation of new states in the east of Poland, which might serve as shock absorbers between Germany and Russia. But if a new Ukrainian republic is set up on present Polish territory, it would apparently be under German domination, for the Germans already hold half the land it would include. The Russians could hardly feel easy about that in view of Hitler's long-standing ambitions for the Russian Ukraine, which would be just over the border. Today, Russia called up another 500,000 conscripts, which will make a total of 4.5 million men under arms. It must be repeated that no such force would be needed for a new partition of Poland. Nobody but Joseph Stalin knows what Russia's policy is going to be in the near future. Possibly even he does not know, but is waiting to see how he can turn events to the best advantage for himself. But it seems likely that he, too, has been surprised, and not pleasantly, by the rapidity of the German conflict.
Unnecessary fades. Is there so much material? But notice a few things. It's the beginning of the war, but we're not yet in it. This is 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And notice that he's speaking of what we then used to call the Ukraine. We now just call it Ukraine,
right.
But he calls it Ukraine, the Ukraine. It was quite an unfamiliar reference at the very beginning of the war, I suppose.
During those years, people really tuned the radio to find out what was going on.
Yeah, well, there was no television. There was no television.
And news coverage really came of age during the World War II years.
Wouldn't you say that the single figure in American broadcasting, radio broadcasting, who was most central in that coverage, just in terms of his popularity, was, I'm blocking on his name, for CBS.
Edward R. Murrow?
Edward R. Murrow.
Well, he was in the late 30s and early 40s, he was broadcasting from London, and he'd be on the rooftop of a broadcasting
describing
building.
Describing a bombing.
This is London, he'd say, and he'd send shortwave reports home. The
Elmer Davis, whom we just heard, was a regular newsman, but I believe he then was given responsibility in the government for much of our propaganda effort.
He was I think, Office of War Information.
Something like that, wasn't it?
Part
yeah.
of that, you know. Yeah. In 1991, on the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor,
mm-hmm.
on December 7th of 1991, I began on my Those Were the Days program a four-year odyssey, a four-year look at radio and World War II. And we followed radio week by week, the news broadcasts, the commentators, the variety shows, the special shows, the propaganda shows, everything, week by week, and finished it up. The war was over then, 50 years later, on September 1st, I think, of 1945. Now, back in 2011, on my website, which is speakingofradio.com, we decided to replay those 4 years' worth of Those Were the Days programs, adding them to the archive on our website, week by week. And now, through 2011, 12, 13, 14, and now we are finishing our 50th anniversary look at radio in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
The war is going to end again on speakingofradio.com. So anyone who has access to our website can come in and listen to the complete shows and find them all in our archive. And it's really an amazing look at how radio covered World War II. A real
And the website is simply Speaking of Radio.
www.speakingofradio.com.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
What was characteristic of the portion of American radio that was entertainment rather than direct coverage of the war? What did the war do to, say, to American comedy on the air?
Well, comedy shows, for example, often had subject matter, something to do with the shortages.
Yeah.
Fibber McGee and Molly, for example, they were a very, very patriotic sponsor, Johnson's Wax,
mm-hmm.
very patriotic personalities, Jim and Marion Jordan. And the storylines written by Don Quinn were very patriotic. And if one show, Molly was considering joining the WACS, the Women's Army Corps. On another show, Fibber thought there was a German spy in the neighborhood. All comedy-based, but usually at the end of the show, there would be a message, a serious message, from either Harlow Wilcox, the announcer, or from Jim and or Marion Jordan, saying, save your used fats and turn them into your butcher for ration points. Save your newspapers and recycle the newspapers. Save your used pots and pans. And then they'd say, we need extra people to buy war bonds. And that was a recurring theme all over radio. Bob Hope did the same thing. Almost all the big radio shows, all the comedy shows, and many of the dramatic shows, whether they be a serious dramatic anthology or a detective show or something like that, they would often have some kind of a storyline that dealt with World War II. And sometimes you'd have the Lux Radio Theater, which was a series of radio versions of movies. They would do radio versions of war movies, Casablanca, or other things like... Now, Casablanca is not really considered too much of a war movie with airplanes and fighters and all that sort of thing, but there was a plane at the end of Casablanca. So we get all of those stories. And radio was responsible for selling millions and millions and millions of dollars of war bonds.
A crucial figure in all of that, as I remember it, and she's not represented in our playlist today, was Kate Smith.
Absolutely.
Say who she was. A singer, but she was the singer who was, it has been said by some, was made for radio. She had a clear, penetrating, kind of simple voice, which just came through the loudspeaker with great,
oh, sure,
great clarity.
Well, Kate never really had any vocal training as such, but she had a very strong voice, and it was clear as a bell.
Yeah.
And people liked her. She was friendly and homey, and she had the opportunity to sing Irving Berlin's
God Bless America.
That's
exactly right.
Right. And yeah. She was on radio all through the war years and after, and she was one who made a real nice transition to television.
Yeah.
She had a TV series as well.
We are going to work in one or two more quick things before, well, one more quick thing before we go to some commercials, and then we shall continue. We've talked about Jack Benny. Here is number 7 on our playlist. the Jack Benny show opening.
The Jack Benny program, presented by Lucky Strike.
Feeling low,
feeling tense.
These 8 words are common sense.
Smoke a lucky
to be your level best.
Smoke a lucky
to be your level best.
Your level best. That's just how you'll feel when you light up a lucky, because Lucky's fine tobacco picks you up when you're low, calms you down when you're tense, puts you on the right level to feel and do your level best. It's important to know that fine tobacco can do this for you. And LSMFT, LSMFT. Lucky Strike means fine tobacco, mild, light, ripe tobacco that means real smoking enjoyment for you. So next time you buy cigarettes, remember, Lucky's fine tobacco picks you up when you're low, calms you down when you're tense, put you on the lucky level where you feel your best and do your best. Yes, smoke a lucky to feel your level best. The Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny, with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and yours truly, Don Wilson.
We are about 2 minutes away from a necessary stop. In those 2 minutes, what are some of the great things in the history of American radio during that classic period that are not on the playlist? You've got the playlist in front of you, obviously in 2 hours, with a lot of commercials as well. We can't fit in 100 other things that we otherwise might have used. What would you say are some highlights that people should go looking for?
Well, everybody talks about the War of the Worlds, the Orson Welles broadcast, of the H.G. Wells story. Turned radio inside out just about, and Wells proved to people that
we have something from that series. That was the Mercury Radio
Theater.
And we have The Count of Monte Cristo by Orson Welles coming up a little bit later.
And other things were the anthem at the end of World War II by Norman Corwin. A number of things Norman Corwin wrote and did on radio.
He was a spectacular person.
They were great milestones. But really, the coverage of the war was a very important part of radio. That little clip we heard from Fred Allen before, Harry Vinzel said, "That eagle unsettled me." Well, there was, they had a live eagle with his trainer in the New York studio where Allen was doing the broadcast. And Allen was interviewing the eagle's trainer, and the eagle got away from the trainer and flew around the studio up above, threatening the studio audience with leaving a signature someplace here and there. Huh. And the audience got out of control, and they were laughing, and the crew and the people on the stage were nervous about the whole thing. And that was one of those memorable broadcasts. And, of course, another memorable broadcast from radio was by Agnes Moorehead, who starred on Suspense in Sorry Wrong Number. A great story by Lucille Fletcher, and it was repeated on Suspense about 7 different times over the years. Mm-hmm. And one of the most memorable things on radio.
We pause necessarily in just about a moment, and then on to yet other highlights from the golden age of radio, including some very funny guys there you haven't yet heard. Before we go beyond the great radio comics of that period, one more from Jack Benny. And this is with another man who was a mainstay of his programming, Mel Blanc, a man of 1,000 voices.
He did everything. First of all, Mel Blanc was the voice of Bugs Bunny and Porky Pigs and Sylvester and all the other Warner Brothers cartoon characters. But he did a lot of work for Jack Benny, some of it vocally only. He was the voice of Polly the Parrot on the show. He was the sound of the Maxwell. You know, Jack Benny's Maxwell was such a rickety old car that it came to life by hiccuping and coughing and sputtering and all that sort of thing. Along with, they'd start, you'd hear the sound of a starter, and all of a sudden, you get all that noise, which Mel does a lot better than Chuck does. And then he played the role of Jack Benny's violin teacher, his frustrated violin teacher. He was the train announcer when Jack would go to the railroad station.
Uh-huh.
Train leaving on track 9 for Anaheim, Azusa, and Cucamonga. And then he would play a variety of other characters as needed through the program.
And here he is as one of them, described as a disgruntled audience member named Fink. But the Fink is spelled in a rather elevated way, F-I-N-Q-U-E, suggesting pretensions of grandeur. At any rate, I don't really know this cut, but it is recommended. I'm sure you will recognize it. Here it is.
Ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow, February 14th, is Valentine's Day, and it's also the birthday of the star of our show. So here he is, Jack Valentine Benny.
Thank you. Hello again, this is Jack Benny talking, and Don, that was very nice of you to remember my birthday. How did you ever think of it?
Well, Jack, a strange thing happened last night. I ate at that Chinese restaurant you recommended.
Uh-huh. And Don, I hope you broke open one of those rice fortune cakes.
Oh, yes, I did, and the little paper said, 'Tis better to give than to receive, and Monday is Jack Benny's birthday.
And what did you bring me for a present, Don?
Well, it was too late to go shopping, so I brought you a pocket full of fried rice.
Too late to go shopping. I told you to have lunch there, not dinner. Anyway, Don, I'll take the rice. There's a friend of mine getting married Wednesday. Thanks very much.
Well, tell me, Jack, how does it feel being a year older?
Don, I don't know. It seems strange to advance another year. But then, on the other hand, there's something exciting about reaching 40. Yes, sir.
Well, Jack, you may be 40, but I must say you look much younger.
Well, Don, it's nice of you to say that, but let's face it. I mean, my age is beginning to show, you know, a little wrinkle here, a gray hair there. Time marches on. Now, let's get on with the program.
Oh, wait a minute, Jack. Before we get into the show, I have a little surprise for you.
A surprise, Don?
Yes. Now, the whole audience is going to join in. All right, everybody. 1, 2, 3.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Jack
Benny. Happy birthday to you. Wow. Thank you, everybody. Thanks very much.
Oh, wasn't that nice, Jack?
Yes, very nice, Don,
But what?
Well, I was watching one fellow sitting in the front row, and he didn't sing at all. As a matter of fact, he had a frown on his face, and I'm just curious to know why. Oh, mister?
Me?
Yeah, would you mind coming up here on the stage for a minute?
Okay.
Now, look, Mr.
Fink. F-I-N-Q-U-E. Fink.
Well, Mr. Fink, I'm just curious to know. You were the only one who didn't sing Happy Birthday to me. Why was that?
Do you sing to me on my birthday?
No, but then how can I? I don't even know when your birthday is.
It's December the 24th, and all you hear people singing is Jingle Bell, Jingle Bell, Jingle All the Way. Not one word about Fink.
Well, that's too bad. Now, look, Mr. Fink.
F-I-N-Q-U-E.
I know.
That's French.
Yes.
In Paris, it's Fink K.
I don't care what it is. All I want to know is, if you've got this chip on your shoulder, why did you come in here in the first place?
Who wanted to come in? I was standing in line for the Amos and Andy show, and some guy came over and told me that they was giving away refrigerators in here.
Giving away refrigerators?
In radio or programs, either got to give you entertainment or a refrigerator. Now, where's my icebox?
Well,
You're not getting an icebox, so go sit down.
Okay, okay. 12 programs this week, and I still ain't got a stick of furniture.
Keep quiet, please.
It's Mel Blanc on the on the Jack Benny program.
As Mr. Fink or Finkway.
Yeah, and there's about a page and a half again of dialogue from between Mel and Jack, but how funny it was and well written.
Who did the writing for Benny?
He had four writers. Four writers, and they stayed with him almost the whole run of the thing. They changed it once or twice during the rule, but not totally. The thing about the Jack Benny program was that I was very lucky because I interviewed Jack. I interviewed, these are separate interviews, but I interviewed Don Wilson and Dennis Day, Frank Nelson. Frank Nelson was always the floor walker who said, "Yes, can I help you, Mr. Benny?" And I did interview two of Jack's writers and many number of characters on the show. And all of those interviews are posted on my website, speakingofradio.com. So you can go in, click on, listen to the interview, and then you have an option, if you like, to listen to a complete Jack Benny program.
And speaking of radio comics, there's yet another one, and you did interview him, and we want to get to an excerpt from that. But first, let's go to the closet. I have Fibber McGee and Molly in mind. Say just a word about the program, and then next up on one of our playlists, which I'm sure Mike can find, is Fibber's Closet. But first, describe that program. It was also, I think, originated here in Chicago.
It started in Chicago, right, in 1935.
Yeah.
And they were on the air for Johnson's Wax. And they were given initially a 13-week contract, and Fibber, Jim Jordan, said, "I don't want that contract. I don't want a 13 weeks. I won't do it." It was starting in May sometime, or April, I should say. And he figured there wasn't enough time to build any kind of an audience in 13 weeks starting in April. So he insisted on a 26-week contract, and they gave it to him, which was pretty gutsy because this would have been their first network exposure. But by the end of 26 weeks, the show was on the air. And over the years, they...
Were they people out of vaudeville or something?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Jim and Marion. Jim was a singer. Marion played the piano, sang a little bit, too. And they, with the writer by the name of Don Quinn, they developed all the characters for Fibber McGee and Molly. And they came on every week with a situation where they had an integrated commercial. Harlow Wilcox usually came on the scene talking about Johnson's Wax products. They were initially on the air without a home. They had no home was mentioned. I mean, they were on NBC, but they had no radio place to live. And they were on the road because they were driving a car because this Johnson's Wax Company wanted them to pitch Johnson's Carnu, the product for polishing cars.
Now, should we hear the Fibber McGee Closet first or the interview first?
Well, a clip from the interview would be first.
And then
you hear something about the whole closet.
And that's what
right?
we do then. It's our number 16 on one of those lists. And this is Chuck's interview with Jim Jordan, who was Fibber McGee.
What about that closet, as long as you brought it up?
That also came from the Smith family.
It did?
Yeah.
The full closet with all the...
No. In the Smith family, I told you that these people became affluent. They got dough, and they had a Davenport. They were lace curtain Irish people, but they had a Davenport. And this Davenport had a spring in one certain seat that would squeal when you sat on it. And if you wanted to embarrass anybody, you'd say, "Sit here," you see. And that became it was a horsehair sofa, and which were in vogue years ago. And that became the Smith family's horsehair sofa. And when you say anybody was going to sit here, the audience would know what was coming. And it was... they'd laugh, and we said, we'll find something like that. When we started the McGee Show, we said, we'd like to find something like that. Could become, we called it a running gag. A gag that you could throw in any place. And we tried several things. I remember one was we tried a shade that flew up, and that was no good. And we tried other things, and we kind of gave up on it. In one show, to show how slovenly these people were, McGee went to the closet and opened it up, and all this stuff fell. They had so much stuff in the closet, couldn't hold it, and it fell out. And then we said, "Well, gee, let's try that again." So we tried it again, and maybe we have something here. Let's do it again. And then later on, a couple more weeks, we did it, and that's where it came from. That's where the closet came from. But the idea of that kind of a thing came way back from
the sofa on the Smith family. Gee, that's really interesting. Yeah. I'm glad we asked.
Probably the idea of this, of those things that we did, many of them came from the theater. Like when we were young and doing things on radio, we would think of something that we had seen when we were kids on the vaudeville stage that we would bring in. That's showbiz.
That's a wonderful moment for me to sit in the living room of Jim Jordan in Beverly Hills, California, as he talked about how the hall closet gag developed on his radio show. And while I was with him in his home, he showed me around the place, and I kept looking for a hall closet. And I said, "Where's the hall closet?" And he kind of chuckled a little bit. He says, "Well, open that door." And I opened the door, and it was this closet neatly stacked with scripts of his radio shows. Very neat, very precise, all mint quality stuff. And I didn't hear the closet, but those who tuned in to Fibber McGee and Molly often heard the hall closet.
And here it is.
Well, 9 o'clock is swell, Foggy. I appreciate this a lot.
Good. I'll go home right now and start setting it up. I'll just duck out the side door here if you don't...
No, that's not the side...
That's the hall closet.
No,
that's not the...
As much a treat as that was for the listening audience to hear that closet crash, because your imagination could see everything anybody ever had in a hall closet, the studio audience always looked forward to that because they could see a single sound man knocking all of this equipment off a series of stairs, about 5 or 6 steps, and he'd start at the bottom and work his way up to the top, and all this other stuff would fall down upon the next crashing thing.
A certain amount of what we've been listening to did come from Chicago. That came originally from
initially
Chicago.
From Chicago, right.
But here's something that originated in Detroit, I think, and was a mainstay of American radio for, I'm not sure how long, you will know, The Lone Ranger. When does it begin?
It started in 1933 and continued well into the 50s and beyond, and for many, many years through the 60s and 70s, reruns on nostalgia programs could be heard listening to The Lone Ranger, now, Masked Man and his...
When we opened tonight, we had the opening of The Lone Ranger, and I use that as an intro, so we won't replay that. But here is the end of a Lone Ranger episode. It's called Two-Bit Cattle Troll. I have no idea exactly what it's about. I don't imagine it's one that you particularly remember, but our friends here at the station have located it, and they think it's representative of the classic Lone Ranger. And it dates back to roughly the late 30s. So here is... Oh, by the way, there were 2 or 3 Lone Rangers. The first one died,
well, there were a number of Lone Rangers, but there were two who were really the most remembered. Brace Beamer became the best-known voice of the Lone Ranger, but his predecessor, Earl Grazier, died in an automobile accident. And we were all broken-hearted at home as kids listening to this, and what was the Lone Ranger doing in an automobile? We couldn't figure that out. But the scriptwriters at WXYZ in Detroit had to do a lot of reshuffling and change the scripts a little bit, and they had the Lone Ranger becoming seriously ill for about 2 weeks' worth of Monday, Wednesday, and
Friday
shows.
Which one are we hearing
shows
here? This is from 1937.
Okay, yeah. Well, this would... 37...
this be Brace Beamer?
This might be Earl Grazier.
The first one.
Yeah.
Here it is.
What's that ahead? Reckon, Bill, that's another ranch we gotta cross.
And more toll to pay?
Reckon so. Traveling comes high in these parts.
Pay up or turn back.
Turn back and then first two will collect again.
Lawson, almost frantic, went on his way. With every ranch he crossed, more cows were taken. The cattlemen no longer asked for 1/4, but each demanded the return of the same number of animals originally taken from him. When at last they reached Clem Peabody's ranch, less than 100 cows remained. Lawson stared at the cattleman, his temper beyond control.
Oh, you can all go to blazes. I'm here. And what cows I got left are mine. I bought this land, so clear off.
1 minute, Lawson. You want the land, but what will you do for water?
What? Ain't there water here?
Well, sure to mention it, Bill. You got to get your water from the next ranch. And old Skinflint Lewis is awful stingy. I'm afraid he'll want cash money.
I get it. The whole thing's a put-up job.
You'll realize that at last, huh?
I realized it when you called that horse Silver. You done this. You schemed to get the cows back to these ranchers.
Lawson, you can stay here on Clem's land and do without water. Or you can let Clem keep the cattle that's left and the cash you paid and clear out.
He was better off before we tried to go honest.
You didn't try in the right way.
Boys, we're quitting.
Let's get out of here. I had enough.
Come on, you keep your darn ranch and cows.
Thank you, Bill. Just sign this paper. I already got raw down.
You give it to me. Hit it already, huh? There. Now we're leaving here.
Let's start now. The sooner the better.
Hold on, Butch. Don't go back the way we come. We're heading for the hills.
But that's a...
I says we're heading for the hills. If we go back across all them doggone ranches, we won't even have our horses left.
Hi-yo, Silver!
Come on there, Silver, old boy! Tuttle's ahead! We'll see what he's signaling us for! Hi-yo, Silver!
They made great and eternal use of the overture to William Tell.
Right, right. And that was really was an earlier show, and it did have Earl Grazier as the Lone Ranger in there. Later years, after Brace Beamer took over the show, the ending was slightly different, and many people will remember that when the crooks were captured and they were turned over to the sheriff, and the Lone Ranger, they talked about him, and he was there, but they never mentioned his name, and he would all of a sudden leave, and someone said, who was that masked man?
Yes.
And they'd say, him? He was the Lone Ranger. And then out in the distance, you'd hear, Hail Silver, oi!
Yes.
Another thing that was evident on this, did you notice that the Lone Ranger was talking to his horse, Silver? He did that a lot, because he had to move the story along, and if Tonto wasn't there, who also would help move the story along, he said, let's go, Silver, we've got to meet Tonto and head him off at the silver mine. Those were the days.
There's a bitter little joke about how the two of them are surrounded by Indians who are going to kill them, and the Lone Ranger says to Tonto, it looks like we're in for it, Tonto. And Tonto says, what do you mean, we, white man?
Yes, indeed. Long ago joke. Worthy of Henny Youngman, I think.
Yes, it's a bad order. Henny Youngman, take my wife, please.
Right.
So we paused for the usual reasons. Then I want to turn to something really rather different, namely solo performers of some special high quality of undisguised intelligence doing comic monologues. I have two people in mind, Henry Morgan and Gene Shepherd. These are perhaps not as well known as all that we've heard before, but it's a genre in radio history which I particularly enjoy, and I go for it on the internet sometimes, looking up at the great internet audio archive and find some of these and listen to them just for my own pleasure. Mm-hmm. All of that to follow after this.
This is Milt Rosenberg on 1590 WCGO.
And right back to Chuck Shaden. I fear we're not going to get through this whole playlist. No surprise to me.
That's all right.
But the genre I was just talking about, monologuists who had some real intelligence and wit, and at the same time could be sometimes rather puncturing in their social commentary. Two particularly come to mind. The first is Henry Morgan. And then the second is Gene Shepherd. Just a word or two about Henry Morgan.
Well, he was known as a satirist on radio, and he was a comedian, and he had a lot of opinionated things to say about some of the sponsors that he dealt with, and he was doing that on radio with a studio audience and all of that sort of thing, and he was well liked, but it never could pile up any big ratings. Fred Allen could kid the sponsors and he often kid at the network vice presidents and things like that. But he did it in kind of a more popular edition. Henry Morgan, very well done, did a good job, and he used to kid his sponsors as well.
Here he is for just a minute or so.
The biography of our Henry, entitled, Is Morgan Really Dead?
I'll never forget my first night in Shanghai. Shanghai, city of mystery and intrigue, where east meets west and west meets east, and north-northeast meets south by southwest by west. Shanghai is not like most American cities. It's like most Chinese cities. At the time, I happened to be an agent of the secret police, and I remember the day I reported to my superior officer. I approached his door and remembered the secret knock. I had forgotten the secret knock, so...
Come in. What is it?
He screamed. K94372 reporting, sir.
Hello, K9.
He joshed.
K9, I have a secret assignment for you, known only to myself.
What is it?
I don't want to tell you.
I'm doing some violence here, and I'm fading because I'm really eager to get to the one of the two that I've just been talking about, who was one of my great favorites. And I still look him up on the Internet and listen to old programs of his. And that's Gene Shepherd, who was also sort of a local boy originally from around here.
He was from Indiana. He was in northern, northeastern
Actually
Indiana.
Born in Chicago. I just looked at his biography recently. Uh-huh. But then he lived in Hammond.
Hammond, Indiana, yeah. Right. But he was the guy who wrote the story about the Christmas story.
That's one of his more famous things, yeah. But, right. But he had this program in New York on WOR, which I used to listen to when I was a kid. And I was just delighted by the fact that he ran in all directions and always had something brilliant to say, but was also, again, sort of eccentric and a little bit unpredictable and sort of running risks towards the edge of things. He was a fascinating talker, one of the greatest monologuists of all time, Gene Shepherd. And here's one bit of his.
Oh, yes. Oh, excuse me. I forgot to bring you the good tidings that at UCLA, and as you know, the West Coast has always led in cultural achievements in the last 50 years in one kind or another. I mean, it brought to us such giant intellects as Stanley Kramer, Tony Curtis, Doris Day. It's all kinds of big people there have been molding our culture like the silly putty that they made it into. But Hollywood's got all kinds of things, and among other things, it has UCLA. And out there at UCLA, the University of California at Los Angeles, they have now a new course called Sensitivity Training. Hello, we now take you to the Sensitivity Training section of UCLA, where a Sensitivity Training course is now in auction. Bring it in, please. Ladies and gentlemen, we're speaking to you now directly from the floor of the Sensitivity Training session, now in full swing here at UCLA. I am speaking to you very quietly because the people are exceedingly sensitive who are now working in this training section. They are seated in a circle as 1722 students now, all working on a sensitivity problem. They are waiting to see who has the first trauma while we watch, and we are waiting for the first nervous breakdown. By the way, a young man is now beginning to, he's standing up now, a young man with high cheekbones. Beautifully, beautifully done. He's falling on the floor now. They're all standing over him. A magnificent example of sensitivity in action. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we return you to our studios in WOR in New York City. We return you from the campus of UCLA, the University of California at Los Angeles. The sensitivity training session is now in action. Now, take it away, WOR. Whew, it was exciting. Boy, oh boy, you know, that's a three-credit-hour session, too. Yes, it's an elective.
He would go on and he would do this for hours on end. That's only about a two-minute clip. Here's another somewhat longer clip titled Troop Train Ernie.
And suddenly the train begins to slow up. We feel it slowing up. And the tracks are on you know how they have the raised tracks? And there's a long sloping embankment down on each side of the train, you see, because this was flood country there, and the tracks were raised up off the ground. Well, we're looking down, and the train slows up and stops for water. from working out. You can see down there, they got the, you know, they got the big tank, and the guys are when they go ding, 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 the guys walking around with the lanterns. And we're looking down, and right down below us, on the blacktop road down there, is this little white shack. A little white shack, and on the side of it, there is a sign that says Coca-Cola. Another sign, a big one, you know, the neon, eat. And then there's even a bigger one that says beer. Well, the three of us look. The train has stopped. Shepard says to Zinsmeister, how about a beer? Zinsmeister says, yeah, that wouldn't be bad. Ernie says, I'm broke. Shepard says, I'll pop. Zinsmeister says, great. Shepard says, all right, Ernie, I'll pop if you'll go. Ernie says, great. Shepard reaches down, pulls out a couple of bucks, hands them over to Ernie, and Ernie hops down. Boop. And this thing is about up to his head, you know. It's not hopping down out of a Ford V8. He hops down, and he goes down the embankment, down the rocks. This thing is about a 45-degree angle. Ernie wearing his shorts. Ernie wearing his dog tags and his GI shoes and his socks. And I see old Ernie go down there, and this, it's just getting twilight. And the twilight in the south goes on like forever, and it's just getting fun. The sky is orange and blue and green, and you can see the black hills back there. And Ernie goes down to the blacktop, and you watch Ernie. I could see Ernie. Me and Zinsmeister are looking down, and of course, we don't want to see anybody. You know, you're not supposed to leave a troop train. That is absolutely the worst thing you can do. This is a terrible, terrible army sin. Well, Ernie has left the troop train. We're just sitting there. Somebody comes along. I don't know. Ernie went back to the latrine. I don't know where Ernie is. Ernie? I don't know. We're just sitting there, see, waiting. We don't want anybody to see. We're just sitting there, keeping our mouths shut. And we see Ernie go in, and you can see him in the light is lit thing. You see Ernie talking there, and he's pointing to stuff, and he's buying popcorn or something. You know, Ernie's on our way down there. And they're arguing. You see, one thing about the South, the instant a soldier came into any place in the South, it was four times more. Anything. Anything immediately just cost four or five times more. So Ernie is arguing it out down there. And then we see Ernie with a paper bag, and he's got the beer. Well, Ernie is talking to the guy. The guy's giving him his change, and suddenly the wheels go.
You want to know how that ends? Find it on the Internet, the Internet Archive, which has a great deal of old radio on it. Do you have any of Gene Shepard on your website?
No, he's beyond the scope of my era.
He's just an official account. In the golden years of old-time
radio.
No,
he was in the 60s with all of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, he was in the 50s.
Yeah.
And the 60s.
Yeah. Right.
I thought him one of the most interesting people ever on the air. I enjoyed him tremendously. Mm-hmm. As I did Bob and Ray. Speaking of comic things, when we return, a touch of Bob and Ray in the night. As we continue directly after these words.
Milt Rosenberg on Smart Talk. 1590 WCGO.
By the way, if you want to put a quick question, the best way to do it right now is by email. We've got some that have arrived, and you can get to us if you just go to Milt, M-I-L-T, at 1590WCGO.com. Milt at 1590WCGO.com for any questions that you are eager to put to Chuck Shaden. Chuck, Bob and Ray is another great comic enthusiasm of mine. Are they in the golden age of radio, or do they come later?
No, they came during the golden age of radio, and they started in the mid to late 1940s in a local station.
That early. Up in Boston,
wasn't it? In Boston area, yeah. And they were each separate personalities on the radio station. One was an announcer, and the other was a disc jockey, I guess. And they hit it off together, and they started doing a few little things during rain delays on the baseball games that the station was carrying.
Yeah.
And they became extremely popular, and their material holds up so well. And they were satirists, and they were comedians. And
what they mock most of all is radio itself.
Oh, radio, sure. Oh, they did The Life and Loves of Linda Lovely and One Feller's Family and all kinds of things like that.
And here is their rather famous The Question Man.
Hmm.
I still get a thrill when I put my finger in an electric socket, played by Ken and Bill and their magic music.
Time is 4 minutes to 5, and we have time for our friend the Question Man today, I believe. Is he here with his stack of mail?
Certainly is.
Time again for questions to answers that you, the listener, have sent in. Today, the Question Man takes up such interesting subjects as what is sky, what is earth, and what is snow, which is your first question.
Snow is frozen water that is deposited on the earth when the currents meet and collide.
A listener in Quincy writes, I am planning a trip to the West Coast.
Which direction should I go? It depends on where she's starting from.
Part two of her question says, you schnook, I'm starting from Quincy.
Well, then you should head west, definitely. Because if you head east out of Quincy, you'll get wet.
Part three of the question says, if I head east out of Quincy, will I get wet?
Yes.
Then another listener down in the same area in Wollaston wants to know, I am planning a summer vacation in Florida. Which direction should I go?
Chlorophyll is the green coloring matter.
I believe you skipped one of the questions, Mr. Question Man.
In the springtime, you'll notice that, and then in late fall, too.
Now, this next question is, what is the green material in grass?
Travel west.
You answered that in the first question.
Oh, I'm all confused. Will you repeat that question, please?
Yes.
The first time it's ever happened to me.
What is the green coloring material in grass?
You know, I don't think I know the answer to that.
Oh, no.
This will ruin us.
You mean
we're on stations all over the world, you know.
Syndicated is a big thing.
$1 million proposition.
You mean you're stuck with a question you can't answer?
I don't know what makes it great. How did that get in here? I didn't have
crazy. Give me off.
Listen again, real soon.
Never again.
Never again.
I'm washed.
Well, the Question Man, who says now to his many radio
drop
fans...
Drop dead. One and all. What are you, dumb? Do you know anything, you people?
I love them.
Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding.
Yeah.
Great.
Let's talk again about Chuck Shaden. We are, to repeat something that we talked about at the very beginning of our session today, we are in the very room, the very studio, where your radio career began.
That's right. Right here at the end of Lee Street in Evanston, yeah. Illinois, is where I had proposed a program of old-time radio shows.
Who did you propose it to?
To a fellow named Buddy Black. He was a long-time and a revered radio announcer and personality in the Chicago area, who had a part ownership in this station at that time. And,
but this station had a different...
It was WNMP.
NMP.
NMP. And shortly thereafter, it was changed to WLTD. And they talked about it being W Limited, you know. But we started out with a three-hour program on Saturday afternoons, right from this studio. And we had news from Mutual at 1:30. I think 2:30 and 3:30, and we would go off the air at 4. And then at 3:30, they also had, I think, a five-minute sports announcement. So it was very difficult playing complete old-time radio shows with these 5- and 10-minute mm-hmm. breaks in the middle of it. But we persevered with it, and we managed to start building an audience. So that was a wonderful thing.
I was a part of your audience.
Well, appreciate that.
Absolutely.
And we
what was the year you began? It was
1970.
And I came to town in 65.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hearing you before I got into radio.
Oh, great. Now, I feel really old now.
I guess shortly after you started, because yeah. I was asked to take up that little stint at WGN in 1974.
Oh, yeah. Well, by 1974, I was moving towards the end of my 5 years at this radio station. In 72, I became the general manager of WLTD, right?
Yeah.
And started building things from a programming point of view.
Uh-huh.
And by that time, I was doing a four-hour show on Saturday afternoon called Those Were the Days. I was doing a three-hour show Monday through Friday mornings from 7 until 10, playing the old-time radio shows and playing recordings, nostalgic recordings.
It was a daily feature.
It was a Monday through Friday daily feature for 3 hours.
My goodness.
And then fellow by the name of Bruce Dumont, who is now also being heard on this radio station.
He is indeed.
He started off with an hour show on Saturday afternoons before my program, and then we worked out a thing where he could do a two-hour show following mine with talk, entertainment, interviews, and so forth. And I'm sitting here in this small studio right now, and there's a big picture window, almost a picture window here in the studio, and there's a little alley kind of thing along the side here. And one day, Bruce Dumont and one of the broadcast engineers, who also moonlighted as an automobile technician, decided to do a program on the air where the technician would tune up Bruce's car outside the window of the studio, and they hung a microphone out the window to under the hood of the car where the engineer was, and Bruce was in here and finding out what was wrong with the car and what kind of tune-ups they needed and all of that sort of thing. It was really like a truth or consequences quiz, contestant quiz, doing that sort of thing. Bruce had a dancer tap dancing on the desk in the studio here one day, was hearing the tap dance sounds. At noontime, there was a man by the name of Bill Nigut who read poetry and read passages from current novels and books and interviewed other esoteric people on the air. At 1 o'clock, a talented young guy by the name of Ted Weber did a three-hour program called In Your Town, and he would spend the 3 hours talking to people who were active in the arts in the town, or he talked to librarians who would recommend a certain book, and so forth and so on. And then at 4 o'clock, we had a fellow by the name of Mike Schwimmer who came on and did a program called The Yesterday Shop, and this was big bands and jazz and ragtime, and he held forth until 6 or 6:30. At this time, this was a 1,000-watt daytime station, and was sunrise to sunset, so we had to sign off at whatever the official sunset time was. So in December, we had to sign off at 4:15, but otherwise the latest time in the year was like 8 or 8:30. I think that's changed a little bit from these days.
Well,
but anyway,
we're now a 24-hour station, of course.
That's right.
Are there any sundowner stations left in the country?
Well, most of the sundown stations they stay on the air, but the signal is reduced in size.
Yeah.
They reduce the power and the direction sometimes.
Or they shift to internet.
Well, they continue on. Almost every radio station now is heard on the internet.
For sure.
So whether you can pick it up. See, when we were on the air, we were fortunate. People wanted to listen to the old-time radio shows. Not much else was on in that era. I'm doing 1970. I'm doing radio nostalgia from a radio period that ended in the late 50s. So, you know. But people wanted to hear it, and people from the south side were driving up north on Saturdays. They'd park along the beach at Northwestern and listen to the program.
To catch your signal.
To listen to the show, you know,
yeah.
They'd be come around. Or they'd find out where the studio was and park down on Lee Street.
Oh,
here,
wonderful.
And listen in. So we had we're building the audience for it.
It was a very fulfilling career.
And it was. It was very nice, and I spent 5 wonderful years here. Then the station was sold. And then
was that when it became WCGO, or was that
no? Like, no, it became. Let me think what it was now. The whole story of this is on my website, by the way.
All
but,
right.
But anyway, they changed its call letters, and it became a different station, because when new people buy a station, they buy it for a reason, and they have a reason because of programming or for other ideas. So then we left, and then continued on for the next 25 years on WNIB in Chicago, which was the classical music station.
I knew those people later on. What their names were?
Bill and Sonia Florian.
Exactly.
Right.
And that was the second classical music station in town.
Right.
Since sold to, I forget what big outfit, and now it's just another kind of rock and roll station.
Well, that's right. Now that station is WDRV, I think,
The Drive.
The Drive.
Right.
And then when WNIB was sold, then we moved to College of DuPage in 2001, and that program is still on WDCB.
Still persists there.
90.9 FM. Steve Darnall is hosting those for the days after I retired in 2009.
Look how generous we're being. We're advertising another radio station. Well, what day and time does he do that?
Saturday afternoons from 1 until 5.
Fine.
At 90.9 FM. And that's also on WDCB.com, so you can pick it up there, too. And I'm proud of Steve. He's done a wonderful job. He continues with the magazine we started publishing during this program, the Nostalgia Digest, and so that continues too. So I'm very happy doing all of that stuff. And it's a nice little nostalgic trip for me to come back here and be in the same studio. However, there's one thing I noticed that's missing.
What's that?
The old clock up on the studio wall. It's not the old clock up there anymore. It looks like a digital timepiece of some sort.
It is a digital timepiece, yeah. And it doesn't coordinate with the clock that I've got on the control panel.
Well, that's nothing new. We had a Western Union clock on the wall in here at one point, and that corrected itself supposedly every hour, but it was, I don't know what time zone they were working in.
I've invited email, and I just have a few in front of me, probably more to come, though we may not have time to read them. Mm-hmm. But here's one that I really appreciate. Micah in Elmwood Park says, I like how you have lighthearted topics on Fridays. I love the heavy stuff, too, but you're quite right to dial it back a bit for the weekend. Well, we don't necessarily do that every Friday, but I'm tempted in that direction, so you've caught on to that. And right now, also, you've probably caught on to the inevitability that commercials are due. Uh-huh. In fact, at the moment, overdue.
Chicago Smart Talk continues with Milt Rosenberg on 1590 WCGO.
As is always the case, Chuck, when we are doing something full of excerpts, whether from movies or from radio or from theatrical performance, you never get through the whole playlist.
Right.
So we had some Dragnet we wanted to play. We can't do that. We had yet other stuff, including Basil Rathbone as Sherlock Holmes. But here is a great figure in American theater, and we started in theater, and then he made a tremendous impression in radio before he went to Hollywood, Orson Welles. This is the Mercury Theater of the Air. And just to give a touch of it, he did classics. You've made mention, of course, today of his famous War of the Worlds program, which was part of this series. Another part of it was The Count of Monte Cristo. Just to give a bit of a feel for that, here is the beginning of the Mercury Theater's broadcast of The Count of Monte Cristo, and it dates back to 1938.
The Mercury Theater on the air. Columbia Broadcasting System takes pride in bringing you Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in another broadcast of the unique series which signalizes radio's first presentation of a complete theatrical producing company. For these programs, the regular member stations of the Columbia Broadcasting System are joined by the coast-to-coast network of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Tonight, the Mercury Theater turns to another of the great narratives and adventure stories of the world of literature, The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas. And here again is the director, the star, and producer of these broadcasts, Orson Welles.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. There is no reasonable explanation of Alexandre Dumas. He was a rich man. We note with interest that he went bankrupt in the theater. He was a revolutionary. His grandfather was a marquis. His grandmother was a negress. He was born as Napoleon became emperor. He died in poverty as the Germans marched into France. He wrote The Count of Monte Cristo as a newspaper serial, and shortly after the last installment, a ball and a bullfight were organized for him in Seville, and finally in Algiers, the customs men let his baggage through without examination. Such things don't and can't happen today, but then, neither does Alexandre Dumas himself, the wildest romance of a man who could and did openly maintain at 70 numerous establishments and a literary factory as well, whose quantitative output is equaled in the arts only by Rubens' studio. There's a good story about what Dumas Père told Dumas Fils. Father, said the inventor of Camille, I have just read your latest book. Have you, my son, said Dumas Père. What's it about? I'm not sure I have. Tis no secret and no shame either that the Chateau Monte Cristo was haunted by many ghostwriters, and that its owner signed his name to more books than anyone could ever write. 'Tis not expected of Pharaoh that he build with his own hands his own pyramids. And the mere blueprint of one Dumas plot is an airtight alibi for a whole career. Of all these, out of question, the most gloriously complex, possibly the most impossible, a mathematical miracle, as perfect as watchworks and as big as Pittsburgh, among hundreds, one Dumas plot persists as the most ingenious tall story ever perpetrated by the mind of man. God's vengeance on radio scriptwriters and your indestructible delight in spite of us. Here then is a humble 57 minutes worth of The Count of Monte Cristo. In the year 1815, I, Edmond Dantès, was first mate of the Pharaoh, bound for Marseille from Smyrna, Trieste, and Naples. The day we left Naples, the captain was attacked by a fever and died within 3 days.
Well, this is the ultimate tease. A long and fascinating introduction by Orson Welles, which he did for most of those.
Yes.
But, of course, you've not heard any of it. But if you want to hear The Count of Monte Cristo by the Orson Welles' Mercury Theater of the Air, you can find it on the Internet. There are many places to locate it, and that's one of the great resources of modern time. We've got just about 2 minutes left before we go off the air.
That Welles broadcast, what you just heard the introduction for, it was 2 months almost exactly before the War of the Worlds,
yeah,
which came later. And this was a sustaining program, or one with no sponsorship.
One noticed that
until,
at the beginning.
Until that time.
Yeah.
And shortly after the War of the Worlds, the Mercury Theater on the air became the Campbell Playhouse, because his...
he got that sponsor.
He got the sponsor.
Campbell Soups, that was.
Campbell,
yeah.
Soups, right.
Yeah.
And that's where many good broadcasts were heard, including Lionel Barrymore's annual Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
That was heard.
And it was only a few years later that, when it was the man of... an old man of 24 or 25, mm-hmm, thereabouts, he was called to Hollywood and made Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, correct.
Incredible career.
Yeah. I never got the call to Hollywood after I started the program here.
Nor did I.
40 years ago.
Nor did I. Thank you so much, Chuck, for joining us today.
Milt, it's a pleasure to be here, and congratulations on your longevity in radio and then your new home here.
My new home, which is your old home.
You might be interested in knowing that this is a very good place to start out.
Oh, well.
I did okay, so I
you
hope you will
very
do as well.
Well. Indeed. And we're going to end, as we sometimes do, with a touch of moving, soothing classical music as a way of setting the right tone. Here, then, the second movement of Mozart's 21st Piano Concerto.